Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Andre Rodatis, who will be with us for a little while. He's at Gary Tong's house in British Columbia. Hi, Andre, and also Marvin Garwin.
Hey, good morning,
and
Paula.
Good morning. Marvin,
didn't mean to
Garwin,
step on you.
And no. And Chuck Thurston, hi you guys. So good to have you on.
Hey, Paul.
We're back. Yay.
Good to be with you all.
Yeah.
Hi all.
It's been a busy 2 weeks. We were at the summer study session in Illinois, and it was really a wonderful time. I just so enjoyed that conference. Can't tell you how much.
Yeah. Wonderful.
It was the first conference I've been at. Yeah, exactly. It's been a while, you know. I think it was like 2019 that we last had a summer study session where we all gathered and actually were able to hug. We're a hugging bunch of people. We like to hug. We hug a lot. We've been accused of being a family reunion, which is kind of nice, you know. Are you guys a family reunion? You see, you're always hugging each other.
Pretty big family.
It's a big family, yeah.
Well, it was pretty ahistorical. I mean, I think we've all been part of this Urantia movement for most of our adult lives, and I cannot remember a period of time ever where we did not gather annually in the summertime somewhere at some conference, and it's been 3 years. I mean, I don't remember a time like this where there was a hiatus like that of 3 years. So it's been pretty impactful, and it was, I think, all the more joy for us to be with each other in physical presence and enjoy each other in that additional way. You don't know what you have until you miss it for a while, you know, and it brings it home.
Oh boy!
With much grief. Yeah.
So true, and we got to explore Melchizedek, and I got to say, I feel I'm more in love with him than I've ever been. I just have more appreciation, for what he did. and what does. They did, what and does, exactly. And all of those plenaries were fabulous, I thought, and the workshops were awesome. I just loved it. Wonderful conference.
Well, all four of us presented in one way or another, and it was marvelous. I was very, very impressed with Chuck, your presentation, and Paula. Mm-hmm. You brought it home. You closed us out. It was just wonderful. And Marvin, what a wonderful panel discussion you led. It was great.
Yeah, it was. It was great. Just so thoroughly enjoyed it.
It's, well, and you know, just by way of context, I did really miss the Cosmic Citizen Gathering here for the 2 weeks. It was a jam-packed 2 weeks, and it was so full of so many good things. And you know, it's just the nature of material life. You can't be in two places at once and do two things at once. And but I really did miss our little gathering here and our kind of triangulation of minds and hearts and souls. But it was interesting to spend an entire conference talking about the experiences and the insights and the historical events related to Machaventa. And to kind of get a deeper sense of this order, the Melchizedek Order of Sons, And for me, it really fits with what we're talking about today and have for the last several times on Cosmic Citizen. And it's given me a deeper appreciation of who we are in the order of things, as sons of God. We're cousins to these orders of the Lavanan Dex and the Varanan Dex and the Melchizedek. We're all created primarily as, in a sense, of out of the lineage of the eternal son, eternal mother son, we're created beings, and we're also, in some senses, co-creators because we create offspring and we get to experience that, and it's just the whole experience of being a son of God and what that means, and a deeper appreciation both from what we've been studying here in Cosmic Citizen and of the conference. Of what it means to be of that order, as compared to the daughter of God, so it's been rich. It was rich in that way as well.
Well,
it was
descending sons and ascending sons. That's kind of what's so interesting about this paper we're reading and about the Melchizedek order. They're descending sons, and of course we're ascending sons. Anyway, they come down to help while we're trying to climb our way up. And it's such a beautiful, I don't know, symmetry of ministry and interest and endeavor that kind of fates in common, you know, that our well-being is wrapped up with them and the success of their work is wrapped up with us. And we get this, you know, feeling of collaboration and camaraderie even, potentially, with not to mention Michael, the creator son. So I just think it's really interesting the way the whole scheme is designed to foster
the
future roles that we're going to play. But these things that we're reading about are hugely important to that.
Yeah, it fits together like this incredible puzzle, this incredible, beautifully designed work of art, you know, mosaic, I think is a word they use in some places. And how you're right, Chuck, how complemental these things are, the descending and the ascending. And I often, one of the things I've been wondering about, and, you know, whenever we talk about the rebellion, we talk about the Lenon Index and their nature, and we'll probably get to this, and it's true of Melchizedek as well. It often occurs to me that of these various orders, we are so unique and different in the sense that we're indwelt by a fragment of the Father, an actual undiluted essence of God with whom we're meant to fuse, and none of these descending orders, although I seem to have a nagging memory, and probably one of you will fill it in, that there can be some merging with deity fragments when they turn around and ascend, many of them, at some long time, future time. They may have some destiny. I know that the our angels who ascend with us, I think they merge at some later time in some more intimate way with the presence of the Mother Spirit or the Infinite Spirit. But in any case, that's one of the things that distinguishes us.
Yeah.
That well, no
look,
other being.
McAvena, of course, had an adjuster during his.
Right.
Right. Approximately 100 years stand here. That must have been something for him. I can't imagine. But that was crucial.
Yeah.
That adjuster experience was crucial. Because then that same adjuster ended up indwelling Jesus, having all that experience to draw upon, indwelling a divine son on a planet like this. So, that was brief. Not like, you're right, they don't ordinarily have adjusters, but McAvena had a taste of that.
What an amazing thing to contemplate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that adjuster has since been personalized, of course, and is now what, chief of all adjusters for Nebadon or something like that?
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Andre's the photographic memory among us, so. But you all do pretty good too, actually. But little details like that escape me sometimes. And I always appreciate Andre so much for clarifying all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, it speaks to the... Andre, is that you? Did you want to...
Well, I missed that one little reference you were trying to recall.
Oh, that indwelt McAvena and Jesus is now chief of adjusters was personalized and is now chief of adjusters for Nebadon, I believe.
Yes, he is. Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking about just the distinguishing nature of the fact that most of these descending sons, and we're all sons in common with them, but what we have this, not only are we ascending, which differentiates us, but we have this indwelling fragment of the Father with which we fuse, and that's kind of a unique experience to our order. How that sets us apart in some ways. And I've often thought about that in terms of Lucifer and going astray and Caligastian Satan, mm-hmm. and how they did not have that intimate interior presence. They were less advantaged in some ways.
Mm-hmm. There's that interesting detail about the Melchizedek, where the father Melchizedek, has been to paradise and has seen the paradise deities personally. Yeah, met with them, knows them, right? Which is not true of the Lenanadex. I mean, most, the rest of the Melchizedek order doesn't necessarily have that experience, but at least one of their order can report back and say, yes, the paradise trinity is real. He's got, the persons of the Trinity, they really are real. He's been there. He's met them. So that gives the Melchizedek kind of even though, again, like you're saying, they don't have adjusters, but it still gives them a confidence in the reality of the universe, or organization or the lineage and all of that, and relationship to the paradise deities. Whereas Lenanadex, at least within their order, have not had that experience, and they don't have adjusters. So that's how they can be kind of self-deceived into deifying themselves, essentially, which is kind of what happens in rebellion. Because they're nonetheless brilliant, and they easily fall in love with their own minds, apparently. Well, I don't know.
They can.
Not that it happens all the
time. Yeah. But Lucifer did.
Right. Where in comparison to the Melchizedek, who maybe had some errors in judgment, but they've never entered into rebellion in the sense that that we know about with Lucifer. So
hey, are you guys hearing the echo? Or is
I'm hearing
just
a little
me?
Something.
Okay.
Is it with all of us?
I'll go ahead and mute in case it's me, but it's silent
in
here.
Oh, I will too. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just hearing a bit of an echo, which is kind of, you know how it distracts you. It's kind of funny how
seems
that
better
is.
Better now.
Yeah, it does.
I'll
don't
be
know
running
that's
errands
so good,
with
thanks.
Gary in the background, so I'll be off air for a little bit.
Okay. Well, have fun.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Will do.
Yeah, Isadora says there has been an echo, so thanks for letting us know, Isadora. I know that can be so distracting when you hear that, and then it's hard to follow the conversation, and the conversation is worth following. And, you know, I want to say that it was a delight to be at the conference and have several people come up and say, man, we listened to the Cosmic Citizen. You know, one person and shout out to all of you, man. I appreciate you so much, and we all do. And I think I told several people, you know, I'm so glad you like it because we have so much fun. We'd probably do it even if nobody was listening.
Even nobody was listening.
You know, but it's really gratifying to hear that people benefit from it, that they enjoy it, they look forward to it, they listen to it multiple times a week. God bless you. Thank you for that. I mean, you know, we are four very, very sincere students of the Urantia book. I can't think of any more sincere students of the book than the four of us are. And I know there are many, many more. You know, that's not to discount all of the wonderful Urantia students out there, you know, so devoted to studying this thing for decades. And but it just means so much to us to know that it's of value, that it has value to all of you. And we really appreciate it. So thanks. That was wonderfully gratifying for me to hear that from people that I had no idea were listening, you know. So that was really, really awesome. I so appreciated that. And,
there was one really, really dear friend and sister who came up and was almost tearful, and bless her heart. And I'm so poor with names. I don't know, Paul, if you recollect, but we were talking about it, and Chuck as well, and she was saying that, and it's interesting to think about these times, you know, where there are, relatively speaking, so few of us in the broader culture. And she used the word lifeline, I think, several times, that it was a lifeline. The Cosmic Citizen show was a weekly lifeline, and listening to it multiple times as providing a sense of cultural connection, you know, that I'm not out here alone, because she is alone geographically. She's far from any other readers where she lives. And it just provides a sense of, okay, you know, I'm not out here all by myself. I'm part of a culture and a reality and a common human and spiritual experience, even though it's very shared by very few right now, relatively speaking. I'm part of something. I belong in, and I'm part of something, and I'm immersed in that reality along with these other wonderful sisters and brothers, and that meant a lot to her. And you know, that meant a lot. You're right, Paul. That meant a lot to us, because, you know, we're here, the four of us, and we're in separate locations, and we don't know, you know, who's mm-hmm. listening or when. And to get that feedback is very enlarging of perspective for us as well. So it's just good to know, you know, you never know where lives will be touched here, and also with the history of the show on into the future, you know, as things unfold. So the angels have a sense of that. But we have such a meager sense, you know, of the larger sphere where we operate, you know. And that was it was very touching. You're right, Paula.
Very touching.
Well, part of what's going on with that, I think, you know, as we read this material and talk about it every week, or almost every week, I mean, we're developing a common ground of understanding among ourselves.
Yeah.
Because I think we all learn something every time we dig into this, you know, we get new insights or you see new correlations or how the, you know, this marvelous multi-dimensional universe of meaning that we find in the book, you know, we delve into it and we mutually discover new understanding, I guess what I'm trying to say. And so people that are listening, like this person you're describing, they're sharing in that, even though they're not physically present. They're on a mind level that there's something being shared there, that common ground of understanding is reaching out. You know, the more of us who have this understanding, the more it kind of creates a fabric of culture, in a way, amongst ourselves and everyone else who's studying the book. So I think there's a lot of value in that. Just in that, having some shared understanding, you know, the universe frame that we discover in the book, to be able to grow that, you know, socially maybe, but there's something going on, I think, on the mind level, where that understanding, as it grows, can reach beyond ourselves and does.
Well,
that's part of what's significant about that.
Yeah,
I agree.
There's another layer to that that I got as a result of the, you know, the workshop that I did. There was some really interesting conversation, but the whole conference focused as it was on the phenomenon of epical revelation and Melchizedek's. Bestowal here as an emergency revelation, and in a sense, an experimental revelation. And our fifth epical revelation is, in some sense, even a more unprecedented experimental and emergency revelation, because they tell us that the Melchizedek's they don't do it very often, but in emergency conditions, they're the ones that intervene and engage in these special bestowal missions, and that has happened before, but never in the entire text do they say that this phenomenon of a major written body of revelatory material without a manifestation of a celestial being on the planet in some fashion, that seems unprecedented. That seems, in a sense, an additional layer of experimentation on our world. And
I think so, too.
And what has occurred to me is, and this bears direct relationship to what we've just been talking about, as you're saying, Chuck, the development of a culture and what we're doing with Cosmic Citizen and what we're doing in this whole Urantia movement around this revelatory stimulus. I wonder from time to time whether there aren't whole I don't know how to say this. I think of visitors, but I think of observation going on about this phenomenon, and that they're learning a great deal about the ripple effects of this kind of revelatory stimulus, where they haven't really done it before, and they're looking at maybe how it affects us, how it affects our minds, how it affects our relationships, the whole way that we are living our culture, and how it ministers to us. And it is a whole culture. I mean, and it's a precursor to a culture that's going to be far more widespread at some point in the future until it eventually pervades the cultural stream of our planet. And they're looking at this phenomenon and studying it and understanding its impact and drawing lessons and conclusions about how mortal lives are affected by this much information given this early in this set of conditions. And I think they're drawing lessons for future application as to, you know, how this experiment works out and how they can apply it in ongoing. I wonder about that. And all that has sort of come up as a result of the conference and the discussions.
But isn't that interesting?
I think we've noticed and talked about is, if you look at the sections in the book where it talks about planetary mortal ethics, you know, on a normal world,
mm-hmm.
and the
mm-hmm.
revelations of universe reality that accompany those various stages of advancement
right.
on a normal world. At each stage, it's limited. I mean, the revelation of, you know, the higher realities of the universe are limited within each of those stages of development. But in the Your Answer book, we've got it all.
Mm.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, all the way
mm-hmm.
to paradise, but also in philosophically and otherwise. I mean, there's teachings in there that people, you know, oh, that's too hard, I can't understand that, or it seems beyond the reach of human comprehension. But we should appreciate, I think, that what that's doing is it's kind of projecting a, you know, a future possibility of comprehension,
right.
let's say, that
yes,
reaches
it is.
All the way to light. It reaches all the way. In a way.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no holding back.
It is,
I mean,
in a way,
the
slingshot effect.
Yeah, yeah. The authors of some of the papers, I mean, they, you know, they come from the center of reality. It's just, they don't hold
I
back.
Know.
And if we can't understand it right now, you know, we've all had the experience of going back. Like right now in my little study group, we're tackling the forward, just to study the forward. And it's amazing to dig into the forward. Parts of it, you just got to shake your head, but it's coherent. You know, it's not gibberish. We know it's saying something important. And to exercise our minds and stretch our conceptual reach to try to contain what they're talking about there is a thrill. And I don't know. I'm sure they are, Marvin. I'm sure you're very correct that they're observing carefully how a lot of this material is taken in or not taken in or understood or not understood, but it has the potential to carry us very far into the future.
I get lost in the thoughts about what they must think of us. And I don't mean it in any negative sense at all, because I don't think they think negatively of us. I think they have nothing but compassion for us. I think they look at us and think, I think their hearts ache. I do. I think their hearts ache for many things, for many reasons. Our loneliness, our confusion, our suspicion, our doubt, you know, because coming from their perspective, we have nothing to be afraid of. We have nothing to fear, and yet we don't know that, see? They know it, but we don't. And what a position for them to be in, you know, to want so desperately to give us comfort, to reassure us, and not be able to, and to then have to trust us to do that for each other, you know, to give us this information and trust us to try and communicate it. Well, you know, they know it was difficult for them. They say it over and over and over again. This is tough. I wish I had the word to give you that would convey to you what I'm trying to, you know, the concept I'm trying to portray, but I just don't have a word that's good enough. And it was hard for them. It's even harder for us, you know, because we are dealing with a race on a planet that's very jaded and skeptical, and all of us have PTSD to one degree or another. We're all traumatized to one degree or another. And so our challenge, those of us who take this thing on, who take it on with all of our heart and know this thing is superior in so many ways. It's superior in its intellect. It's superior in its love. It's superior in its compassion. It's superior in its enlightenment and its truth. It gives us so much. We get so much from it, and we just burn to give that back to humans who are suffering. But that's no easy thing to do. And, you know, especially not at this stage. Maybe it'll get better. I have faith that it'll get better because I believe in evolution, and they reassure us that, you know, just trust evolution. It will get better. You know, humankind is on the march. you guys are going to get better, and this is going to resonate with you more and more, and more humans are going to crave to know this kind of thing. And, you know, so just keep going. And that has kept me going for years and years when I think, gosh, you know, we went to an expo. I would go to an expo on Thursday night. I would, you know, have a training meeting with a group of wonderful outreachers in that location, and whether it be San Francisco or New York or L.A. or Austin or wherever it was, we'd have our training meeting. We'd go down on Friday. We'd set up our booth. Seattle, Marvin, I did it with you. We'd set up our booth on Friday. We'd work all day Friday, 10 hours Friday, 10 hours Saturday, 10 hours Sunday. So 30 hours over a weekend. And if we got 20 people to pick up the book and felt like, man, they may really read it, you know, they may read it.
We felt good.
How significant it felt over that period of time. And I remember these events where it would be 80, 90, 100, and 100 plus books that people bought. And we knew what they were getting themselves into. Most of them did not.
Yeah.
And they had an inkling. And you know, I mean, the continuing challenge of people taking that and then eventually reading it and moving across the threshold of becoming not only familiar with much of the book, but serious students of the text. And, you know, you're right, Paul. It was a remarkable experience. There's just two things that in addition, as you were speaking, were occurring to me that's really quite related to this theme. And that is, it's sort of related to what you were saying too, Chuck, that the distance between where we are in some respects evolutionarily on this world and where we should be in terms of awareness is extremely wide. Almost maybe unprecedentedly wide, and there is a tension associated with that in living life at this time in this world, on this world. There's a tremendous tension between that flows from the discrepancies between the cultural impoverishment in terms of cosmic perspective, spiritual perception, really understand what's going on. And the level of advancement materially in some fashion, there's a tension associated with it that makes life in this world very hard. The contrasts are, you know, as you say, Paula, PTSD. I mean, sometimes they're traumatizing what people experience.
They are traumatizing.
And their sense of distance between what ought to be and what is a very heavy burden on this world. And then along comes this revelation, as you mentioned, Chuck, that gives us a perspective that really begins to touch into some of the early eras of light and life in terms of what they show us. And I think it's a tremendous experiment on their part to go ahead and see how that affects us. But I don't think it's trivial. I think they recognize that our need is so desperate that they have
to
give us something. Yes, that has the possibility of spanning that tremendous gap between where we are on this world and where, in many respects, we ought to be because of where we are in the stages of things and the fact that we have two failed epical revelations. And where I end up with that is that it results in two things. One is that for those of us who immerse ourselves in it and embrace it as our life perspective and our universe perspective going forward, and we live within that reality, it's a tremendous gift for us. And we celebrate that many, many times here as we talk about it on the Cosmic Citizen and in the movement. We're overwhelmed almost by how amazing it is to have these understandings in the midst of this discrepant world condition. And at the same time, it presents us with an unprecedented set of challenges as to how to proceed in this world with this gift in order to multiply the talents that have been given to us. you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it's,
yeah,
it's, that's part of it as well. It's tremendous gift, but tremendous challenge because of the nature of this gift.
And tremendous desire to give it.
I think they're watching. I think they're watching all of this unfold and learning.
Of course they are.
A lot. Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah, that was, yeah.
Well,
you know, when
so
I think about.
Oh, go ahead, Paula.
Well, I just want to add one little thing from Jesus that Jesus said when he was talking to the two brothers at Emmaus. And I think of the Urantia book in this same light. You know, they're walking along and he's telling them, surely, you know, you, well, let me tell you what I know about this man that you're talking about because I'm more than familiar with him. And he gets that wonderful, statement about, being as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land and, all of these wonderful metaphors and the things he says. And then he ends it saying that those who believe in him shall have eternal life. That he will pour out his spirit upon all flesh, and that this spirit of truth shall be in each believer a well of water springing up into everlasting life. Did you not understand how great was the gospel of the kingdom which this man delivered to you? Do you not perceive how great a salvation has come upon you? Man, when I think about how grateful I am for these teachings, that's what I think of. I hear Jesus say, do you not understand how great this gift is? You know, do you not perceive what a wonderful salvation has come upon you, that you have this marvelous revelation of truth? And I want to understand, you know, I want it to move to deeper and deeper levels of my soul. And I want so desperately to give it to the world. I always have. But, you know, you can only do so much, you know, and the world will take so much. And then it will, you know, maybe not take it. But it doesn't mean you shouldn't try. You know, that's what I always come away with, is you can't give up. You have to keep trying because sooner or later you will break through. And it will break through because it is what it claims to be. That's the way I look at it, you know. It is what it claims to be. And you know, we can... Go ahead.
It all happens in the hearts and minds of individuals. That's what you're talking about. It ends up being a very individual thing, whether you know, the capacity and willingness to be open. The thing I wanted to point out a minute ago, unless you have more you wanted to add, Paula?
No.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Oh, okay.
No.
And I came across a statement in Paper 195 recently that I hadn't noticed before. I mean, it's sort of obvious even maybe from our own observations, but they say that for 300 years, Western thinking has been progressively secularized. And it just kind of got me thinking about the sort of the mindful or intellectual or thoughtful acceptance or understanding of the reality of God, you know, kind of taken away by secularization. Secularization, you know, secular movements and frame of thinking is that, oh, this all just happened, you don't need godness, you know, to complicate things, to explain reality, right? But that, of course, and it's interesting how the book in that paper regards this secularization. On the one hand, they talk about the dangers of it, that godless civilization cannot really survive. But at the same time, they warn us not to throw away the gains or the benefits from this, you know, the secular movement or the secular, you know, states that we're
revolt, in. Revolt, I think it calls it.
What's that?
It's a revolt. It's a revolt. It calls it, I think, at one point a revolt, where we overthrew totalitarian religion. But now,
overthrew ecclesiastical totalitarianism.
Right.
Swapped out for secular totalitarianism. But they do tell us not to throw out the gains of secularism.
Right.
There's been, you know, there's some good parts in that we should be careful to retain as we go forward. But we need to bring God back into the picture.
Yes.
And I think that's where people struggle, because they've been raised to think that, oh, God, it's just some made-up myth, a human invention, you know, people came up with to feel better or whatever. They're,
right.
You know, the kind of things that people say.
Well, and not only that, but some of the teachings about God, you know, some of the things we've been told about God that we really don't care to believe, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. So, but going even back to what Marvin, what you were saying, you know, that's part of the gulf, is overcoming this gulf of secular thinking versus thought that includes God, the idea that we can have an inner dialogue with God, that God is with us every moment of every day, as a reality of personal engagement. And I can't imagine living without that, how people do it. It's like, how do they go through even one day without that? But they do, of course, and I did myself for a good period of my life. So I know about that, you know, being beguiled or in the thrall of secular thinking. You know, it can seem sort of convincing, although, you know, the humanist, more secular humanist view of things. I mean, it can seem sensible, you know, we're the smart people, right? You don't want to be ridiculed for believing in some phantasm, you know, or whatever.
It really comes down to a matter of the heart and the head, you know, the head and the heart. Mm-hmm. I mean, the head, the intellect can rationalize these things and can say, well, it just doesn't make sense. You know, it's a fantasy. It's a fairy tale. God's a fairy tale. You know, and I've heard many atheistic people say these very things, you know, that it's just,
you look at that
with your intellect and you say, well, you know, okay, you know, if you're a critical thinker and you know, or scientific, you think, yeah, there's really no proof. I mean, you know, where do they get this stuff? And you can make it sound almost foolish and outlandish, ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
But when you think with your heart, when you look at these matters with your heart, your conclusions are much different. You know, when you look at life, for instance, on this earth with your heart, and you say, well, what's the purpose of it then if it's all for naught? And no wonder you get all nihilistic or all defeated when you think that all that you're going through is just for naught. It amounts to nothing. Yeah, demoralized, exactly. But only God brings meaning into that. And what was interesting to me as we were moving up to the conference was the importance, as you're saying, Chuck, of God in this whole equation. And that's what Melchizedek was trying to do, reestablish the light of God. And God has to be taught. You know, I mean,
revealed, and
has been revealed. It has been. All of these revelations, the two that you say failed, Marvin, they were here to reveal God. And that was what was almost lost with the third one, this knowledge of God, this light, the light that guides the world. The thing that gives us faith in ourselves and each other is God. And without that, you know, we are in the dark. We are lost. We have to have that. Mm-hmm. We all say, how would we live without? How can anybody live without that? This concept of something so much greater than yourself, you know, that brings meaning and purpose to your life.
Exactly. Well, you know, what's interesting about that isn't that, in that little quote I read, for 300 years, Western thinking has been progressively secularized. I mean, there's almost like an implied agency in there somewhere, like that this has almost been done on purpose or somehow it's been made to happen. I mean, they don't elaborate on that, but we can sort of imagine how that might be the case. But what's interesting to me about that is it's an invitation to counter agency. But we can have agency too, right?
And we can have agency too. Yes.
We can advocate for a God-knowing sense of reality in the face of that.
Right. Courageously, and, fearlessly.
Yeah.
We shouldn't shrink from it.
On the accomplishments of secularism. We can actually build on the accomplishments of secularism and crown it with, you know, a God-knowing perspective.
Right.
That
you know, I want to kind of add a little bit of a different layer to but really stay with the conversation. we're speaking about, and just share a couple of things. One is, you know, I've wrestled lately because this passage where they speak of, they say many Christians are unwitting secularists. I think it's in the second to last paper of the book.
Mm-hmm. It's in 195 again. Yeah, same paper.
195, yeah. And what does that mean? And actually, how does that relate to us? And you guys know, I mean, because of my background in therapy and as a psychologist, mm-hmm. I think a lot about, and what speaks to me deeply is some of the literature, and Thomas Keating speaks about this, as to the nature of what he calls the human condition. And I think the Christians are not alone, the Buddhists, the Hindus, the Jews, you know, the spiritual, not religious. I mean, all of us really, at times, I include myself in this, are unwitting secularists. Because what they're saying is, when we are aware of God's presence with us and we are in interaction with God, living interaction with God, we are functioning spiritually or religiously. When we are bereft of that, when we forget, when we drift, when we're distracted, which I don't know about you guys, but I still have plenty of that in my life, you know? There's plenty of times when I'm just whatever, for whatever thing comes along that distracts me or takes me away from that living relationship, then I sort of understand myself as functioning unwittingly, you know, non-intentionally, unconsciously, as a secularist. I'm functioning as if there isn't a God. I'm functioning alone, in an orphaned state. My sense is that is part of the human condition. It is part of our human nature. When left on its own, to drift and to be distracted and to be trivialized and superficialized, and it is only by our greater understanding and our intention, our understanding of the gift that's available of relationship with God, an intimate relationship, and taking advantage of it and being conscious, expanding our perception and our spiritual awareness by virtue of an act of will and of saying, you know, it's my desire, Father, to share my inner life with you, and Master Jesus, to share my life with you, that we move out of being unwitting secularists and move into being living religionists in the living of the gospel, and that it's an ongoing challenge throughout our lives. I don't think we escape it, is the challenge of the human condition. We don't escape it, I think, until we reach the early mansion worlds where we have a fundamentally different nature that we work with. And then I think it becomes much easier. And I think the lesson of the default is that on a normal world, as they say, it's much less of an intense struggle. It's more an educational enterprise to learn how to be in communion on an ongoing, regular basis. But because of our mixed nature and our, you know, our compromised physical and therefore mindful nature as well, it's much more of a struggle for us, and it's one we're stuck with, I think, for the duration. And in the midst of that situation, we're given this amazing revelation, which shows us all of this and gives us tools for understanding the nature of, of the dilemma. And our challenge is both to live it, you know, to try and stay in connection as much as possible, and not be unwitting secularists, and to share that way of relationship with God with others. And this is where the second thing I just want to share, and then I'll be quiet. We are, in a sense, emissaries of a foreign state in this situation. Whether you understand it as ambassadors of a future kingdom or a heavenly kingdom. And I want to read this passage, and it's the lead paragraph in the ordination sermon where he's saying, share with people these truths that happy are the poor in spirit, happy are they who hunger and thirst, happy are the meek, happy are the pure in heart, the merciful, the peacemakers. What he's saying is, as ambassadors of a future kingdom, you have to give people hope, and not hope that their condition will disappear. but that they will have much greater strength and resources for dealing with their ongoing condition. You know, that their meekness, their pureness of heart, their openness in spirit, their humility will win the day in the ongoing challenge of living as a human being in this life. And that's our challenge, is to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jesus says these words. They say, then Jesus spoke, saying, now that you are ambassadors of my Father's kingdom, you have thereby become a class of men and women separate and distinct from all other men and women on earth. That's an interesting statement.
Mm-hmm.
Separate and distinct. You are not now as men among men, but as the enlightened citizens of another and heavenly country among the ignorant creatures of this dark world. And man, I think we're still in the same state, right? It is not enough that you live. Yeah, it is not enough that you live as you were before this hour. But henceforth must you live as those who have tasted the glories of a better life and have been sent back to earth as ambassadors of the sovereign of that new and better world. It's such interesting language. Of the teacher, more is expected than of the pupil. Of the master, not more is exacted than of the servant. Of the citizens of the heavenly kingdom, more is required than of the citizens of the earthly world. Some of the things which I am about to say to you may seem hard, but you have elected to represent me in the world even as I now represent the Father. And as my agents on earth, you shall be obligated to abide by those teachings and practices which are reflective of my ideals of mortal living on the worlds of space, and which I exemplify in my earth life as really of the Father who is in heaven. And he says, I send you to proclaim liberty to the spiritual captives, joy to those in the bondage of fear, and to heal the sick in accordance with the will of my Father in heaven. When you find my children in distress, speak encouragingly to them, saying, and then he shares the Beatitudes. And the Beatitudes are basically saying, you know, you have a difficult lot, but cheer up. You know, it's okay to be in this state. Do the best you can, you know, with your spiritual gifts. But anyways, this whole idea of ambassador from a different country, a heavenly estate, sent back by the leader of that country, to be his ambassadors. Wow, it's just like, that really describes our both our gift and our challenge, I think, with this revelation in this world, in this crazy time in this world.
A beautiful passage. I'm so glad you shared that.
And for years, that passage hung up in Jesusonian Foundation in my office.
Did it really?
That was our guiding passage. That was our guiding passage. Peggy Douglas had a beautiful plaque made out of it, and that was our that passage was our purpose statement. And we hung it up in the office with that great Jesusonian logo that was created for us, and it was our guiding statement.
Yeah. Well, you know what comes through loud and clear from all that to me is that we're not just trying to convince people to believe something, right? What we're trying to do is introduce a new relationship into their lives. That's really what this is all about.
Yeah.
That there's a relationship that every person can have with God, with that sovereign of that higher reality. That invitation. It's invitation to a relationship. It's not trying to convince people to believe this or that. I mean, maybe beliefs serve as an intellectual foundation, but the reality is the relationship.
Right.
It's a whole changed way of life.
That's something people can all enter into. That's easy. It's
all
you accept the possibility.
Right.
Yeah, it's a whole changed way of life in a whole different set of relationships. With God as spiritual parent and each other as sisters and brothers, and really not just believing something, but living that as much as possible day in and day out, which is a very challenging ideal, but every attempt we make to reach for it and every minor success or substantial success in doing that for some period of time is forward motion. It's
forward motion. Exactly.
You know what I've discovered? Every time I get into one of those states where I'm sort of forgetting about God or what you're describing, Marvin, and drift off into secular,
drifting into secularism.
Engage, you know, whatever. What I've discovered is whenever I come back to God, God's always there.
I love that about him.
Yeah, I know something.
He's always there. He's always
okay.
on. He's always
oh,
ready.
Funny.
His
yeah,
arms are always
back.
Open. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not like, well,
I mean,
it's, hitting, slapping us up the side of the head.
Yeah, you kind of tell him, well, Father, I went off and I did this and I did that and I tried this and I tried that. And man, I am weary. And he says, just come and rest, kiddo. You know, it's all good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that's
it. Let's talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about it. You can rest in the arms, in the everlasting arms. And, you know, this life is tough.
What's that great quote from Isaiah? Something about... come, let us reason together or something like that.
Yeah, come, let us reason together, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus said that. The truth never suffers from an honest examination, right? It never suffers.
Yeah.
You know,
but
Andre would be disappointed
in...
We've gotten lost in this conversation for a whole hour.
Oh, there's no disappointment.
Gary and I are going to get to the topic.
Hey, Gary and Andre.
And I didn't put money down yet on whether you would get past the top of the hour, but here we are.
Well, not quite.
Too bad you didn't put money down.
Yes, I know, not quite.
Yeah, Andre,
I'll join you when we're done our
to...
errand. We're not quite done yet.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah,
thanks for checking in.
I'm glad to know you're still tuned in. You had to come in to rein in this wild herd of horses.
I know. Good discussion, though. Very good discussion.
Galloping joyfully into the universe, into the reality of God and the joy of knowing God and living the God-conscious life rather than the unwitting secular life, which we probably all delve into at times. Yeah, and it surrounds us, true. Yeah.
So what section are we on, Paula?
That's a good question, but I think
are we up to number
it's
eight?
The Rhonda Deck.
Section eight?
I thought it was the Rhonda Deck world, but maybe it is the Lananda Deck sons.
Oh.
Do you remember, Chuck?
No,
introduced to numerous?
Well, the Rhonda Deck worlds is a very short section, so let's just read that and maybe read both sections, seven and eight. Yeah.
Okay, very good.
Definitely
Veronda I think...
Deck. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, Marvin, do you want to go ahead and read that?
Sure.
Cool.
Seven, the Veronda Deck Worlds, right? Yeah.
Right.
The second group of seven worlds in the circuit of 70 primary spheres surrounding Salvington. So the second group of seven worlds in the circuit of 70 primary spheres surrounding Salvington comprised the Veronda Deck planets. Each of these spheres, with its six encircling satellites, is devoted to a special phase of Veronda Deck activities. On these 49 realms, the ascending mortals secure the acme of their education respecting universe legislation. Now, this sounds familiar. Maybe we did read
it.
Yeah,
I remember reading it.
We did read it. Well, I'll read it quickly just to refresh us. The ascending mortals have observed the legislative assemblies as they functioned on the headquarters worlds of the constellations. But here on these Veronda Deck worlds, they participate in the enactment of the actual general legislation of the local universe under the tutelage of the senior Veronda Decks. Such enactments are designed to coordinate the varied pronouncements of the autonomous legislative assemblies of the 100 constellations. The instruction to be had in the Veronda Deck schools is unexcelled, even on Uversa. This training is progressive, extending from the first sphere with supplemental work on its six satellites, on up through the remaining six primary spheres and their associated satellite groups. There's a lot to learn. The ascending pilgrims will be introduced to numerous new activities on these worlds of study and practical work. Study and practical work. We are not forbidden to undertake the revelation of these new and undreamed of pursuits, but we despair of being able to portray these undertakings to the material mind of mortal beings. We are without words to convey the meanings of these supernal activities, and there are no analogous human engagements which might be utilized as illustrations of these new occupations of the ascending mortals as they pursue their studies on these 49 worlds. And many other activities, not a part of the ascended regime, are centered on these Verondadec worlds of the Salvington Circuit. Should I go on, or?
Yeah, I remember reading it, and I'm looking forward to it. I think we all decided we're looking forward to whatever those activities are.
So, hey,
well, just the fact that they're, just the fact that it involves the coordination of all the constellations and their autonomous pronouncements, that sounds like a lot to take on right there.
Yeah,
consider
no kidding.
What's in each constellation, the constellation of concerns and issues and worlds and everything, and then you got 100 of those, and they're all making independent judgments that somehow they go up to the next level to be coordinated, correlated, or however that happens. That sounds extremely complex just on the face of it. So it's no wonder there's all of this training involved.
I think about this is really interesting to pause and reflect upon. I mean, we spend 49 worlds, seven satellites plus, I guess it's four, that's right, 49 worlds. That's a lot of worlds. And I don't think we spend a few days on each world. My guess is we spend many years on each world learning the lessons of that world. That's a lot of time spent on legislation. legislation at the universe level, that's the superordinate level, over the constellations. And they say they're doing all this to prepare us as universe administrators. So that will be something that we will be engaged in as well in our service activities. And I take a look at, and it's been in the news lately quite a bit, the process that our government goes through in the formation of legislation, laws, and how complex it is at our way down here level. It's almost overwhelming to me just to look at what they're doing in Congress these days in terms of the compromises and the patchwork and the, just to get legislation through to accomplish things and enact law. And they're going to spend that much time at such a higher level engaged in that kind of activity that they can't even explain to us how that process will happen. That's pretty amazing that we'll spend that much time on that kind of activity.
Yeah. Well, also from what we learned about the conciliating commissions, we sort of get this window into that level where we realize there's disputes and disagreements on every level of universe administration.
Yeah.
That's why these conciliating commissions come in to make rulings and to look at evidence and hear testimony and all of that. And we're talking about them, on even constellation and local universe levels. So it's, that's just sort of the way it is. And I think they say that we should appreciate that as a good thing, that there is that freedom of thought and independence of will associated with personality, where in you know, there can be different ideas and different approaches that have to be worked out and coordinated with cooperation and so forth. You know, it's
right.
not an autocracy where everybody just gets in line and does what they're told. You
right.
know, there's a lot of creative thinking and new ideas being born, you know, all the time. And so what about this? Maybe we should try that, you know. And then, no, we can't do that. Yes, you know. Those kind of, I mean, I can only imagine
a lot of back and forth
commissions have to work out. But there's always that tension, you know, they tell us, between what is and what could be, what ought to be, what was. And all those have an influence that, you know, and all that needs to get coordinated and blended and worked out. So that's probably
Yeah, you know,
a
I think that.
Yeah.
The difference between up there and down here would be that they could sincerely disagree and yet still have true brotherly love, and it wouldn't lead to hate or hatefulness.
Well, you don't have
rebellion.
You don't have rebellious
right.
attitudes. And
right, right.
They're always destructive, yeah.
And I think in general, humans have a tendency to have unreasonable expectations about how long it takes to fix a problem. You know, really,
mm-hmm.
I do. I think humans think, well, you should just be able to fix it. It should just be fixed, you know. Well, okay,
mm-hmm.
but it's just not that easy to fix, you know. It's like turning the Titanic around, you know, or any big ship, say, not necessarily the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes some effort to get it to go back the other direction
well,
or
also,
to go in a different direction. It's just not that easy.
It takes good leadership, too. That can make
it does.
Decisions.
And commitment on everyone's part sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You need all hands on deck. You need everybody working together, pulling together. I mean, I think that's the key. I don't think there's a problem that humanity faces that couldn't be solved if we would just learn to work together on it, all together. You know, it's like the
well,
book
that's,
says,
well, that's
you know,
what a, that's what
we
got to
lift together.
Does.
Yeah. It galvanizes people and brings them together.
People,
right.
you know, you get people say, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do it.
Well,
somebody
you know,
knows,
there's,
or let's at least try
the idea. Yeah.
Right.
There's no, and there's no shortcuts in the process. I thought I remembered this passage and that they actually use the word legislate, which is an interesting connection. But this is a section in where the apostles of Jesus and the apostles of John got together for that 2-week conference, right? And Jesus says they keep going to him, and he says, "No, I'm going away now for 2 weeks. You're on your own." and then they say, and I'll just read this briefly. And this is the story of the first attempt of Jesus' followers. To coordinate divergent efforts, compose differences of opinion, organize group undertakings, legislate on outward observances, and socialize personal religious practices. I mean, what an incredible list. And they're setting down the foundations of socialized religious function, right, which we all have to do. And look with what the fellowship's doing now with its whole constitution, all the discussions and all
mm-hmm.
of this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of endeavor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they go on to say, many other minor matters were considered and their solutions unanimously agreed upon. These 24 men had a truly, I often reflect, it might have been a much easier experience if they had had 12 men and 12 women, but whatever. these 24 men had a truly remarkable experience these 2 weeks when they were compelled to face problems and compose difficulties without Jesus. They learned to differ, to debate, to contend, to pray, and to compromise. And throughout it all, to remain sympathetic with the other's viewpoint and to maintain at least some degree of tolerance for his honest opinions.
Mm.
On the afternoon of their final discussion of financial questions, Jesus returned, heard their deliberations, listened to their decisions, and said, "These then are your conclusions, and I shall help you each to carry out the spirit of your united decisions."
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that, Marvin. It is so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's so important for humanity to learn just that lesson, to contend, to learn, to debate, to, you know, honestly try to understand the other person's point of view. These are all things we could, and it's really extraordinary that those men were able to accomplish that in 2 weeks.
that's
pretty awesome.
That's extraordinary. And the other thing that's extraordinary is all the way up through the system, the constellation, and now at the universe headquarters, we're then finally going to spend a great deal more time learning that art of compromise and working out things evolutionarily and legislation. So it's just like, man, it doesn't stop down here. It continues all throughout our universe ascent at higher and higher levels. So it's a big deal engaging in this process.
I posted a quote on the board from paper 81, just to kind of, you know, it encapsulates this idea. You guys will remember this right away. It's a paragraph or point 13, effective and wise leadership. And they go on to say, this is just from the middle of the paragraph, 81637. 10 men are of little more value than one in lifting a great load unless they lift together all at the same moment. And such teamwork, social cooperation, is dependent on leadership. And Jesus was a sublime leader, such a superior leader, you know?
Yeah, and
something
he
that's been missing on our
that. Yeah,
that they figured out.
That they've developed their own leadership capacity.
Yeah.
And
then he said, I'll help you uphold it.
Yeah, and they also say in another part of the book that wise, really good wise leadership, this is a little sobering, has never exceeded 1% of the population.
I know. That's very sobering.
That's kind of what I was thinking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Jesus also pointed out that there are blind leaders, and blind leaders can lead everyone into the pit.
Right.
You know. Yeah.
Ravening wolves, you know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, if you want to post it, Paul, are those three short paragraphs about the apostles and the experience they had is 144, 6, 10, 11, and 12. 144, 6, 10 through 12.
Okay.
I go back to that one often.
No, that's a good one.
Well, in that last instance with the followers of Jesus and followers of John working things out, even though Jesus wasn't there, I'm sure they all felt his presence. They knew he was coming back, in other words, and they didn't want to be embarrassed by their lack of accomplishment upon his return. I'm sure that was, you know, a strong influence in their minds to say, okay, we got to do this right. We got to make Jesus proud of us, or something like that. You know what I mean? And so, in a sense, Jesus was exerting leadership over that process, even in his absence.
That's true.
By virtue of the nature of his character and his love and concern for what they were doing and everything else, they knew he would pay close attention to what they were doing and, you know, sign off on it if they could just come up with, you know, something they could all agree on. So that's another kind of leadership that kind of goes back to the idea of the sovereign, you know, that we all
It leads from behind in a way. It leads from behind. It allows you to take the lead and is always there for you. And I've come to believe that God and Jesus and our wonderful unseen friends do that. As a matter of fact, they lead from behind. Mm. They want you to get good at deciding what's right. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
For yourself, you know? It's really a remarkable thing.
They represent a standard. That's the thing about someone like Jesus.
Yes.
He represents a standard of relationship and a standard of,
of morality.
Of being.
Of ethics, of integrity. Yeah. It's such a standard that it's inspiring to you, and you want to be like it. You may fall short, but you strive for it because it's inspiring.
Right. That's right. That's an inspiring kind of goal to be reached.
Yeah, it's not radical. It's righteous, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a righteous kind of leadership.
So what's occurring to me in that is the more conscious people become of the presence of God, that awareness can be a way to receive that type of leadership, the spiritual
yes.
leadership of God in our lives can draw us all together, because we all recognize that we're all trying to coordinate with the same leader in that sense.
Right.
You know, a divine higher leadership that's being offered, even if it's not telling us what to do specifically. It's not saying do this. It's not micromanaging or dictating, but it's benign leadership of quality of regard,
right.
and quality of relationship and consideration. It's interesting in that passage at the end they were talking about that, you know, that was as a
mm-hmm.
as the major aspect of what those two groups achieved, was this
right.
new realization of the benefit to listening to the other person and giving them respect and having true regard
right.
for everyone's
hearing them
perspective,
out
hearing
right.
them out, all of that.
Yeah.
So those are all those all come from Jesus, I think, in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, he demonstrated those qualities of regard on a daily basis, just in his interactions
right.
with everyone. And they were picking
right.
up on that, and they wanted to kind of, oh, yeah, let's see if we can be that way, too.
He was nothing of a hypocrite, nothing of a hypocrite. He walked his walk. He walked it. And in so doing, he became the ultimate inspiration for everybody that knew him, because he did live his own teachings. He never
yeah.
said, thus, you know, do, and but don't, you know, do as I say, but not as I do. He never
yeah.
stooped to that. He was the ultimate example of his own high level
yeah.
of teachings. You know,
he
lived the truth. He was the truth, right? It says he was the truth for that generation.
Uh-huh.
And they saw it in him because they spent the time with him.
And they talk about how friendly he was. How friendly he was.
Yeah.
So he established a new quality of friendliness on top of everything else.
Right.
And that is so helpful in terms of working things out with other people.
We all crave him so much.
Yeah.
We crave him more than we know. We crave, he's our Superman, right? He's our Superman. We crave that. We need that as humans on this world. We need that more than anything. We need to believe in something, somebody. And
uh-huh.
he provides us with that, that level of living that he shows us, you can do this. You can do it. You know,
mm-hmm.
don't be discouraged. I've overcome the world. And you can, too. We need
yeah.
that. We need
well,
that kind of leadership.
One of the things that David Kenner's been pointing out lately, and it's not, you know, just conversations online about his film and stuff, is about having a story.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's really interesting. That's a really interesting perspective, I think. Because
I agree.
We know our we know leadership. We know even in mythologies and, you know, other sort of ancestral foundations of our cultures and civilizations, there's stories there. And there's the stories are usually about somebody, and the character
right.
of that somebody ends up having a defining influence on that culture. But people come to know those character values through the stories that are told about that person or whoever it might be.
Yeah. All
so
down through time, the stories and legends of the hero. You know,
right,
a hero
exactly,
that inspires
exactly.
others to live better, to do better.
Yeah.
And
so
it's
you know,
passed down by a story.
We're sort of cautioned not to let our stories be taken away. And
right.
what we have in part four is a huge story. You know, it's the story of the life and teaching of Jesus. You know, what better story could there be?
There couldn't be, if you ask me. I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
It is the story of stories. It is all things, all great teachings culminate in that one life, the greatest ambassador from the other side that ever lived on the planet, you know?
Uh-huh.
Melchizedek was another amazing ambassador. Adam and Eve were amazing ambassadors.
In
even our
story,
planetary prince.
Yeah.
They were all great ambassadors at the beginning.
Needs to be retold. Needs to be retold.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
exactly.
I think
all those stories do.
I think one of the things for me about the spirituality of the Urantu revelation is that it's not just Jesus. And in a sense, if you take a look at the exemplar that Jesus was and what he was basically saying, he was saying, live the life that I have lived, live the way that I live. And the way that I am living is a life of intimate companionship with my Father.
Right. Exactly.
And so the ideal, that's part of it's part of the gift and part of the challenge, I think, of the spirituality of the Urantu revelation is that there are really, in a sense, three modalities of relationship with God. There's the modality of God as the most intimate presence within us, the presence of the Father, you know, who is actually the core of our spiritual nature. The spiritual nucleus of each of our persons. And what Jesus was saying was, if you're going to follow me and emulate my religious life, you will live a life of intimate companionship with the Father that I have tried to live.
Right.
And if I'm example to you, it is an example of intimate interior relationship with a God that is so close that he is one with you.
He's your breath.
Your creator. Yeah, he is your breath. And so there's God as imminent and most inside. And Jesus, for me, has always felt like my closest companion. He's not inside of me. He's with me alongside me. And I couldn't agree with you guys more. The story, the adventure of his life, the thrill and the challenge of living the way that he lived. But it was a life of intimate companionship with a creator parent. And so there's the dual experience of deity, of Jesus as our companion and our master, our teacher.
The father-brother
and the father
experience.
The father-brother experience. And then there's the sister experience of the Mother Spirit and our Mother Supreme, you know, who is deity to us as well. And in the presence of our wonderful angelic sisters, they are our co-workers and our colleagues that work with us shoulder to shoulder and live with us and companion us in a very literal sense, in a different way than Jesus does, in a way that is very collegial and very much we're in this all together. And they offer a different perspective as coming from the third source and center, but they are also deity, and our Mother Spirit is also with us very intimately.
Divine
in
ministry
our minds.
Is what it is. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And it's nurture.
Such a divine ministry.
Yeah, it's nourishment. And so the sense of who God is for us is so rich and diverse, and Jesus is so central to it. But so are our Mother Spirit, and so is our intimate Father presence. And what Jesus was saying is, if you're going to live my way, you have to live all of it, because that's how I live, you know.
Mm-hmm. He's just the ultimate way shower.
About
the story of Jesus that maybe helps with what you're talking about, Marvin, is that when we read the story of Jesus in the Urantu book, we learn about his struggles and the hard things that he had to deal with and overcome, and not always completely successfully, you know, like his relationship with his family and everything else that just was hitting him from all sides all during his life. And you don't really get that from the Bible so much. And the story of Jesus is in the Bible, but you don't get as much of that human sense of what he had to contend with as a human being and how he dealt with that. And the Urantu book gives us lots of detail on that, you know, which is, can also be very psychological at times too. I mean, particularly with the apostles and just the human relationships that were part of his life and how those are described and the contentions that he got into and how, you know, having all the synagogues closed to him. I mean,
imagine
the Son of God trying to reveal, help out, you know, and they close all the synagogues.
The irony in that is.
Yeah, right.
That's a bitter irony.
So, but what we learn from the story of Jesus that includes that type of material is an inspiring sense of, yeah, we all have difficulties in our lives, and we can look to him for inspiration and how he overcame those difficulties. And it kind of reminds me of something I experienced in India. There's a temple in Hampi, which is a ruins from the Middle Ages, a huge city, but it's fascinating to explore and look at. But one of the temples is the Thousand Rama Temple. And on the wall, outside walls of this temple are three rings of panels, 1,000 panels altogether, telling the story of Rama. And people that are into, you know, Hinduism, you know, learn about Rama. And he's one of their sort of heroes, you might say. I mean,
he's their deity hero,
but he's fallible, you know. He's not a perfect.
Right.
So in these panels, as our tour guide was explaining the whole story of Rama, we were walking around the building three times, he was showing us all this. And you pick up on the same idea that there's a character development there, that he had to overcome difficulty and make achievements and make hard decisions and wasn't always right, getting in trouble all the time, you know, all this kind of thing. So, you know, within that culture, they have that story as an example of how to overcome difficulty and strive for higher purposes in spite of maybe imperfections in your own nature. Even. I mean, I don't know if that's not necessarily true of Jesus, but it's similar in that sense. And in a way, that had kind of been taken away from us up until the Your Answer book, was that aspect of the story of Jesus, of the story. So I'm really thankful that we have that now.
Me too.
And we can study that, and we can, you know, just take any little snippet of his life, and it's like such a story, you know, like the wedding at Cana, or, you know, I don't know.
Any little snippet, you're right.
Yeah, there's a story there, and it reveals the character of Jesus, which, you know, is also,
and his courage.
He's the father, right.
Yeah.
As a human being. Showing that kind of courage and confusion at times, really not knowing what to do sometimes.
Right.
And appealing in prayer to the Father and said, look, this is what I'm thinking. You know, and, you know, he would get some sort of assurance and from within. That's where the inner relationship comes in. It's not that we're being dictated or told what to do, but we can propose what we think we should do. And then we'll be feeling on the inside, what's the right, what is, you know, and it was often that way with Jesus. He would look to the, you know, to have a sense of the Father's will through that inner relationship that he had. But it doesn't give the game away. We still have to figure things out for ourselves and struggle with everything we have to struggle with, but knowing we have that companionship is hugely important.
Yeah.
Well, can I go ahead and read section 8?
I was going to actually suggest something radical, Paula, and that is section 8 and 9, and because it really, they sort of set the stage, and but then they get into a little more substance on the Lenon Index in section 9. And even if I like what we did, even if next week when we have, you know, or next time when we have Andre all back, we recap and read that section 9 again. Yeah, so I'd say take both of them or split it with Chuck, whatever you want to do.
Well, let's see what we can get done. Chuck, you know, I'll let you do 9 and I'll do 8.
Oh, okay.
And this is, these sons are all important to us. They end up looming large in our ascent and as administrators and as the fathers. One of the seven fathers is a Lenon Index for us. So it's a very personal thing. So this is section 8 from paper 35, the Lenon Index Sons. After the creation of the Veranda Dex, the Creator Son and the Universe Mother Spirit unite for the purpose of bringing into existence the third order of universe sonship, the Lenon Index. Although occupied with varied tasks connected with the system administrations, they are best known as system sovereigns, the rulers of the local systems, and as planetary princes, the administrative heads of the inhabited worlds. Being a later and lower as concerns divinity levels, order of sonship creation, these beings were required to pass through certain courses of training on the Melchizedek worlds in preparation for subsequent service. They were the first students in the Melchizedek University and were classified and certified by their Melchizedek teachers and examiners according to ability, personality, and attainment. The universe of Nebadon began its existence with exactly 12 million Lenamindeks. And when they had passed through the Melchizedek sphere, they were divided in the final tests into three classes. 1, primary Lenamindeks. Of the highest rank, there were 709,841. These are the sons designated as system sovereigns and assistants to the supreme councils of the constellations and as counselors in the higher administrative work of the universe. 2, secondary Lenamindeks. Of this order emerging from Melchizedek, there were 10,234,601. They are assigned as planetary princes and to the reserves of that order. 3, tertiary Lenamindeks. This group contained 1,055,558. These sons function as subordinate assistants, messengers, custodians, commissioners, observers, and prosecute the miscellaneous duties of a system and its component worlds. It is not possible, as it is with evolutionary beings, for these sons to progress from one group to another. When subjected to the Melchizedek training, when once tested and classified, they serve continuously in the rank assigned. Neither do these sons engage in reproduction. Their number in the universe is stationary. In round numbers, the Lenamindek order of sons is classified on Southington as follows. Universe coordinators and constellation counselors, 100,000. System sovereigns and assistants, 600,000. Planetary princes and reserves, 10 million. Messenger corps, 400,000. Custodians and recorders, 100,000. Reserve corps, 800,000. Since Lenamindeks are a somewhat lower order of sonship than the Melchizedeks and the Verondedeks, they are of even greater service in the subordinate units of the universe, for they are capable of drawing nearer the lower creatures of the intelligent races. They also stand in greater danger of going astray, of departing from the acceptable technique of universe government. But these Lenamindeks, especially the primary order, are the most able and versatile of all local universe administrators. In executive ability, they are excelled only by Gabriel and his unrevealed associates.
Wow, that's quite a statement.
Yeah. It tells you something about the organization of you know, creation and how it's administered. This stuff doesn't isn't haphazard at all. It's so methodical, so purposeful.
Yeah.
It's
well,
reassuring, actually.
No, it is. And if you think about the Melchizedeks, being the firstborn of these descending orders, you know, they're talking about relative divinity or something, that they're a bit, the Lenamindeks are a bit later and lower. It's interesting that the Melchizedeks function as the teachers.
Right.
That they're the, you know, they oversee the educational.
They're the big brothers
of
the universe. Yeah.
Right. Like the older brothers. They're the emergency sons, but they're also the teachers.
Yeah.
So the Lenamindeks inherits the actual responsibility of ruling, which is, you know, in some ways, well, I don't know, one's greater than the other, but it's obviously it's different. So that they become what they say the most able and versatile of local university administrators,
right,
which is a kind of responsibility that the Melchizedeks don't usually enter into, but maybe they can in some cases, like with McAvena being our vice chair of planetary grants. But
it
anyway,
makes sense, though, doesn't it?
Yeah. There's kind of a symmetry there. You have the ones that step into the actual responsible work, and then you have this other group who come from a little higher origin who teach and instruct and oversee and watch out for emergencies and step in when they have to and all of that. It's almost like a ministry. Even though they're sons of God, they're not angelic, they still have that maybe more of a ministering function. Anyway, I don't know. It's just
I was intrigued by the fact that they can't move between groups, too. So once assigned, once assessed, they have to stick with that, you know, assignment. And I can see how that might cause some restlessness within the order. I mean, it was interesting. But I could be anthropomorphizing. That would, you know, to think that I'm locked in for eternity to one assignment.
Well, you know, like, Lucifer
had him. Well, it's, you know, it's interesting.
Right?
They're created with inherent differentials. And in that sense, they're really, but they have to test out. I mean, they don't know who belongs in which groups, but they assign them. After they go through this period of training, it becomes apparent their differential levels of function and capability. And then they're, you know, it's not exact, but for instance, the planetary princes and reserves is just about 10 million, which is the number of worlds that are set out to be inhabited. So there's a certain amount of intentionality about the way they're divided. But what struck me about it, too, is I think part of one quality that makes them closer to humanity than, let's say, the Melchizedeks and the Verondadeks is this range of function, this inherent range of function that seems to be baked in at a certain level, but that seems to stay put for them. And for us, we're born with differentials that have to do with genetics, and that seems to be related to how they're created as well. I mean, they're just created innately with these differentials in ability, and there's diversification of function, which is interesting. And I think of the apostles and how Jesus chose a range of – he didn't choose all brilliant theologians, you know, or brilliant teachers. He chose people that were that were gifted in certain ways and were challenged in other ways, emotionally and intellectually and in terms of capability. And all were valued. All were equally valued. So, I mean, there's a model there in that creative process. But it does create challenges and frustrations, I think, that go along with that territory. I think one of the differences is, and this is a live question for me, is there are some real differentials in where we start out here on this life because of our genetic antecedents, each of us. Each of us has a temperament and a set of gifts and a set of challenges. And one of the questions for me is, I mean, our common destination is the core finality and perfection in our own realm. So there's obviously a future that far transcends our limitations here. But I think those things that make us different will always be part of our histories at the very least, if not part of our nature in some residual way. Those are one and the same. So, you know, there's value to that. There's real value to that.
Well, you're going to read the Lananandek rulers, too, but I wanted to bring in just this one cross-reference because we know Lucifer was a Lananandek, and they've just told us that this order is more inclined to go astray than the other orders. And this is from paper 53, which is, let me tell you what that is. That's the Lucifer Rebellion. And paper 5301, it says, Lucifer was a brilliant primary Lanonadec son of Nebadon. He had experienced service in many systems and had been a high counselor of his group and was distinguished for wisdom, sagacity, and efficiency. Lucifer was number 37 of his order, and when commissioned by the Melchizedeks, he was designated as one of the 100 most able and brilliant personalities in more than 700,000 of his kind. From such a magnificent beginning, through evil and error, he embraced sin and now is numbered as one of three system sovereigns in Nebadon who have succumbed to the urge of self and surrendered to the sophistry of spurious personal liberty, rejection of universe allegiance and disregard of fraternal obligations, blindness to cosmic relationships. So interesting that, you know, these are the beings were, you know, the Lanonadec sons, and Lucifer was one of them. Brilliant, beyond compare in many ways. And yet he succumbed to, they give us two things that he succumbed to, the urge of self, and he surrendered to the sophistry of spurious personal liberty.
The other quality they associate with him, which is related to the to those you just mentioned, Paula, but I think it's subtly different, is pride.
Oh, yeah.
They say pride goes before a fall, and they say the beginnings of his wandering were, they say, he must have nursed a certain pride of his own point of view that evolved into rebellion. So it's the flip side of his brilliance. You know, they say he was unusually brilliant. He was unusually capable. He was one of the top out of so many hundreds of thousands. He was 37, you know, and in the top 100. That's amazing. And at some level, that was also part of his
double-edged sword
downfall. He thought he was so great that he knew better than the whole order of things, and he began to fall prey to the follies of that kind of pride and begin to lose humility. And so the importance of humility and meekness and recognition of our limitations, no matter what our gifts, the recognition of our limitations is such an important and healthy part of our nature, you know?
And our
that's,
balance.
That's part of
Well, we also have to be careful what we think.
We entertain.
This all took origin in his own mind, I say.
Right.
So
let's read 9.
Yeah, let me read this next section.
Okay.
The Lanonadec rulers. The Lanonadecs are the continuous rulers of the planets and the rotating sovereigns of the systems. Such a son now rules on Jerusalem, the headquarters of your local system of inhabited worlds. The system sovereigns rule in commissions of two or three on the headquarters of each system of inhabited worlds. The Constellation Father names one of these Lanonadecs as the chief every decamillennium. How long is that, decamillennium? Anybody want to hazard a guess?
10,000
years?
Every 50,000 Urantia years.
50,000 Urantia years.
Oh, okay.
Years.
Hi, Andre.
Hey,
hi.
You're back. All right. Sometimes no change in the head of the trio is made, the matter being entirely optional with the constellation rulers. System governments do not suddenly change in personnel unless a tragedy of some sort occurs. Tragedy.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, we know about that. When system sovereigns or assistants are recalled, their places are filled by selections made by the Supreme Council located on the Constellation headquarters from the reserves of that order, the group which is larger on Edentia than the average indicated. The Supreme Lunanidek councils are stationed on the various constellation headquarters. Such a body is presided over by the senior most high associate of the constellation father, and the junior associate supervises the reserves of the secondary order. The system sovereigns are true to their names. They are well-nigh sovereign in the local affairs of the inhabited worlds. They are almost paternal. So you're saying about having multiple many fathers. They're almost paternal in their direction of the planetary princes, the material suns, and the ministering spirits. The personal grasp of the sovereign is all but complete. These rulers are not supervised by Trinity observers from the central universe. They are the executive division of the local universe, and as custodians of the enforcement of legislative mandates and as executives for the application of judicial verdicts, they present the one place in all universe administration where personal disloyalty to the will of the Michelson could most easily and readily entrench itself and seek to assert itself.
That explains a lot.
Wonder why they don't have Trinity observers. Anyway, we can come back to that.
Well, something
our local universe.
To, yeah, go ahead. I'll return to it at the end. Go ahead.
Sure. Our local universe has been unfortunate in that over 700 sons of the Lunanidek order have rebelled against the universe government, thus precipitating confusion in several systems and on numerous planets. Of this entire number of failures, only three were system sovereigns. Practically all of these sons belong to the second and third orders, planetary princes and tertiary Lunanideks. The large number of these sons who have lapsed from integrity does not indicate any fault in creatorship. They could have been made divinely perfect, but they were so created that they might better understand and draw near to the evolutionary creatures dwelling on the worlds of time and space. And that can work both ways, too. Of all the local universes in Orbentine, our universe has, with the exception of Hensalon, lost the largest number of this order of suns. On Uversa, it is the consensus that we have had so much administrative trouble in Nebadon because our sons of the Lunanidek order have been created with such a large degree of personal liberty in choosing and planning. I did not make this observation by way of criticism. The creator of our universe has full authority and power to do this. It is the contention of our high rulers that while such free-choosing sons make excessive trouble in the earlier ages of the universe, when things are fully sifted and finally settled, the gains of higher loyalty and fuller volitional service on the part of these thoroughly tested sons will far more than compensate for the confusion and tribulations of earlier times. In the event of rebellion on a system headquarters, a new sovereign is usually installed within a comparatively short time, but not so on the individual planets. They are the component units of the material creation, and creature free will is a factor in the final adjudication of all such problems. Successor planetary princes are designated for isolated worlds, planets whose princes of authority may have gone astray, but they do not assume active rulership on such worlds until the results of insurrection are partially overcome and removed by the remedial measures adopted by the Melchizedeks and other ministering personalities. Rebellion by a planetary prince instantly isolates his power. The local spiritual circuits are immediately severed. Only a bestowal sun can reestablish interplanetary lines of communication on such a spiritually isolated world. There exists a plan for saving these wayward and unwise sons, and many have availed themselves of this merciful provision. But never again may they function in those positions wherein they defaulted. After rehabilitation, they are assigned to custodial duties and to departments of physical administration. Wow.
Universe government
sweep up
workers.
After work. Yeah, sweep up after work.
Right. Wow, that is
so
a great section.
I got a couple of points that jump out to me. I'll just mention them. Obviously, we're probably going to reread this, and I'm glad we are next time we all gather.
We'll have to discuss it, for sure.
Yeah, there's a lot in here. The second last paragraph there at the end of it, only a bestowal son can reestablish interplanetary lines of communication on such a spiritually isolated world. So does that mean that another bestowal? Well, I don't think that means that because, an Avonal or magisterial sons can come multiple times, they say, at later stages, but each world only has a single bestowal, which is, a celestial being born as an infant and spending
right.
a full life. And that
Our
was
Jesus.
Jesus, the Creator's son. So the implication is that it is Jesus who will come and or reestablish these lines of communication.
That's what it means to me, Marvin. I get that clearly.
Yeah.
He's going to have to do it. It won't happen until he does it. He has to do it.
The other thing that really caught me that I've never really thought about is back on the fifth paragraph, 35.9.5. Let's see. They're speaking again of the system sovereigns. These rulers are not supervised by Trinity observers from the central universe. I'm thinking about the parallel to our current situation, actually, that our country is struggling with, as a matter of fact. And they made this point. They are the executive division of the local universe, and as custodians of the enforcement of legislative mandates and as executives for the application of judicial verdicts. So in a sense, the executive branch and the head of the executive branch, and this I think is true of our system as well, expedites or executes legislative mandates and applies judicial verdicts. They present the one place in all universe administration where personal disloyalty to the will of the Michael Sun could most easily and readily entrench itself and seek to assert itself. And it's just interesting to me that and I'm not taking any stand on, where this goes, but what we're grappling with in some of this recent turmoil around what happened around January 6th and all of that stuff in the United States really does feature the central role of the executive branch and how singular and solitary is its authority to create either order or chaos because of its position in interaction with the other two branches of government as the executioner of both judicial and legislative factors. And so it says to me, okay, this abdication by Lucifer created such chaos, and whether that occurred or not here in our situation, the fact that it is at issue is one of tremendous import and leverage in a sense because of the centralization of power in that one set of functions in a tricameral government. So it's just really interesting to think about that.
Is the potential for betrayal of trust is what's at issue here. And what they're saying is these beings' potential to betray the trust of the universe, to betray the trust of the higher ups, and just kind of wreak havoc, I think even from what we read about Lucifer, he went astray. I think he did what he did sincerely. I think he sincerely believed what he was doing was right.
Initially.
And I think, maybe it ever starts out that way. But like they say, once they've gone down that road far enough, it's all but impossible to come back and turn around,
yeah.
You know? And even maybe they get to a point where they know it was wrong, but they still refuse to, you know, do anything about it. Mm-hmm. It's just interesting, too, when they say, you know, that maybe they do this, and because the higher-ups think that so much more good comes out of it, ultimately, Michael made a decision to go ahead and give them more ability, knowing that they could cause more chaos, but then more good comes out of it. But I got to think that our world is one of the ones that has suffered the most from that, which might have played into his decision to come here and personally touch us in such a real and personal way, because we have suffered mm-hmm. so much from the mistakes of this one on Mount and Duck.
Well, and it's a tremendous gift to us as Agendonders, you know, tremendous challenge, but you know, what it means.
We'll see that in
that,
retrospect, I'm sure.
Yeah, very, very few mortals, you know, having in the original, their original life on an evolutionary world, have had to deal with circumstances like these, and the result is both extremely challenging, but the opportunity
rewarding.
To develop spiritual mm-hmm. response, build spiritual muscles that I don't think get built any other way, and so so it's going to end up being a great gift. But in the meantime it's not easy.
Yeah.
It's a tough road.
Well,
yeah.
I think that. The kind of gains
tough
they're talking about, the results from this in the universe, they say gains of higher loyalty and fuller volitional service. I think that's in the future of this world once we overcome all these problems, which we will eventually.
That's a good
point. Not in our lifetimes.
That's a good point.
Not in our lifetimes, but this planet, you may become a showcase of higher loyalty and fuller volitional service in the whole universe.
The sentimental shrine.
Because it's,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, so we can just try to do as much of that as we can, each of us, you know, in our own little ways. But this idea
try
of
to make lemonade
and fuller volitional service, I think that's a really interesting phrase. That
yes, me too.
Service that's undertaken sort of on a voluntary basis. You know,
willingly.
I decide, I want to serve more fully, and I make that determination. In my own heart.
Of my own free will. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's inspired by the need for that. I mean, as we've often mentioned, this is like a DIY planet, you know, in many ways. And that's kind of what we're talking about here. You know, we each discover this higher loyalty and this fuller volitional desire to serve. That's, you know, because nobody else is doing it. Who's going to do it? You know? So we have to do it.
Well, friend, we're going to have to come back to this whole conversation because we're out of time. But man, what a great section! I really enjoyed that, and that was a great study, you guys. Thank you so much, as always. Thank you, Andre, if you're still listening. Love you, you and Gary. Hope you got your chores done. Hope you have a wonderful birthday for beautiful little River, and. That's Gary's beautiful little daughter, for those of you who don't know.
Yeah, happy birthday celebration to the whole family, Gary. Yeah, with Andre, the larger spiritual family. That's great.
Thank you so much.
Love you guys. Love you so much.
We love you guys,
all right.
too. And it was a great conversation as well.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Well, thank you. Happy birthday to River.
I'll pass it on.
And thanks, friend. I can't wait to see her. I get to hug her and that beautiful little Kai, whom I haven't met yet, only by video.
Thank you so much, Kai. Brilliant show.
Oh, thanks, buddy. And thanks, Andre, for hanging in there with us. We love you guys, and thanks to all of our listeners, Bob and Dee and Isadora.
Yeah.
Trudy was on for a while. Love you. Thanks, John in Florida. We love you guys. And Vaughn. And all of those who will listen on the archives. We appreciate you. God bless you.
Are we on? Are we on next week? All on in the live show next week?
Yeah, we should all be on, I think. Yeah.
Good.
Yay. That'll be great.
Yeah.
We can put a ribbon on this paper. Yay.
All right.
So until then.
All right.
Okay.
Have a great week, guys. Will do.
Love you all.
Love you too. Take care. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.